The 90s self-help book, Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, sold over 50 million copies. But a new study shows that the differences between men and women are not as stark as we like to think. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we'll talk about the differences and similarities between the genders. Psychologist Zlatan Krijan of Iowa State University recently published a study that analyzed data collected on 12 million individuals to better understand the differences between men and women. We'll talk about what he found and didn't find, and University of Iowa anthropologist Emily Wenzel will help us put it all in perspective. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. The basic biological differences between men and women are important to understand and vital to the success of our species. But far beyond reproduction, the differences between the genders have inspired countless debates, policy decisions, novels, movies, songs, and of course, self-help books. This hour, we will talk about the differences and similarities between the genders. Anthropologist Emily Wenzel of the University of Iowa will join the conversation in just a few minutes. But with me now is Zlatan Krijan. He's an associate professor of psychology at Iowa State University, and he recently published a study that analyzed data collected on 12 million individuals to better understand the differences between men and women. His research was published in The American Psychologist. Hello, Zlatan.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Great pleasure.
What gave you the idea for doing this research? What sparked your interest?
Well, first, let me say that this research was started together with my colleague, Ethan Zell, who's a psychologist at University of North Carolina at Greensboro. And we were interested in taking advantage of the huge amount of data that's been collected over the decades on gender similarities and differences. So rather really than collect new data, we thought to statistically aggregate previous studies that have examined any kind of gender difference. And in this way, we're able to capitalize on a lot of data that is out there and sort of give a bird's eye view on gender differences.
So in drawing together all of this other research, is it from all over the world?
That is correct.
So this is a cross-cultural study. And how about age? I mean, are there different factors that led you to look at different sets of data?
Mm-hmm. Yep. We really tried to incorporate every and any study, and this then included studies with adult samples and included studies with children and adolescents, although I have to say that vast majority of research that's out there is based on adults and is based in largely Western cultures.
The research that you were looking at has been conducted over the years to explore these differences between genders. But in looking at this research, that wasn't the approach that you were hoping to take, right?
That's correct. So we sort of had a different take on it. Most prior studies, both specific studies and prior aggregates of research findings, have focused on very specific sort of theoretically driven questions regarding differences in, let's say, aggression, differences in romantic style, etc. In a lot of those domains, there were good reasons, let's say, those stemming from evolutionary theory or those stemming from distinct social roles that have been afforded to men and women. There were good reasons to focus on differences in those specific domains. But very often when we discuss gender differences, we really talk in very broad terms. So what we try to do is not so much focus on where are men and women different or who's higher, who's lower, but what is the magnitude of a typical difference between a man and a woman? So if we step out and if we consider all psychological domains, and granted, in most there'll be some difference, but how large are these differences? In other words, how big is the overlap between the distribution of men and women on a given domain? Are the group trends really strong, or is the within gender diversity really large? And that was really the goal of our analysis.
So when you looked at your results, what did you find?
Well, the key finding is that when it comes to a typical psychological attribute, think about romantic attachment or well-being or impulsivity, etc., for a sort of randomly selected psychological attributes out of our many that we could measure, the overlap between distributions of men and women was almost 80%. There was a relatively small standardized difference between these groups. This is how it would be characterized, within statistics. Now, of course, they varied from domain to domain, and in some domains, you do have pretty large differences, and those are pretty consistent with gender role stereotypes such as masculinity and femininity. But on the whole, for most typical individuals, these differences tend to be very small. As a matter of fact, vast majority of them could be characterized statistically as very small.
So can you give me a specific example of one of the characteristics that you looked at where the difference was statistically very small and that people might be surprised by that?
So, for example, personal space. Do men or women require more personal space? So in here, you see very, very tiny differences between the genders. That is to say, diversity within a gender will trump that average trend. It'll be very easy to find men or women that buck the trend. Commitment to an organization you work in, almost no gender difference there. Leadership effectiveness, almost no gender difference there. Occupational stress, so how stressed you get at your work and how much does that negatively impact you. So whereas often there may be small differences here, and as a matter of fact, primary research will often find that these patterns will slightly vary depending on the study population or depending on a specific measure. But when you zoom out, you really see these overwhelming similarities when it comes to most psychological attributes.
What were some of the arenas where you found significant differences?
Yeah, these largely dovetail on prior findings. Things such as physical aggression. I mean, there's a pretty strong difference, about one standard deviation, statisticians would say, between the two groups. Self-described masculine and feminine traits. It shouldn't come as a surprise to most of us that men will tend to see themselves as assertive and confident, and women will tend to see themselves as nurturant and sensitive. And you see that in some of the behaviors, so studies that have looked at how well men and women withstand noxious stimulation and pain, often find men to do that somewhat better on average than women. At the same time, women show much stronger interest in peer attachment and are much more interested in people rather than things.
In looking at these results, is it possible to separate out nature from nurture? I mean, there's the idea that perhaps men withstand pain better because they believe that it's manly to withstand pain better. Can you sort that out?
Yes, that's the age-old question. Unfortunately, we can't. Analysis like this is not very well suited for it. But taking any research findings, the question of how deeply ingrained these differences are they present at birth, are they sort of written in our genetic code, or are they learned through our childhood, is a very thorny one. To kind of illustrate the challenge here, so there is this gender difference in ability to withstand pain. One may be tempted to conclude that as a result that sort of men are born harder or men have a physical ability that women don't have to withstand pain. But there's a different way one can look at it as well. You could say that men have been taught that it's important that they be tough. They do not show pain. So once you subject a person to pain, men may be much more motivated to live up to the social role that they have learned, versus women, of course, wouldn't, because they didn't learn that social role. So even when it gets to specific behaviors, you see it's very difficult to provide final questions about this nature-nurture debate.
What do you want people to take away from this study?
I think probably our common humanity, more than anything else. The fact that in a lot of ways, we are very similar. There are important differences, and we always hear about those. But I think what we don't often hear about is that when it comes to so many things, it's our individual personalities, our individualities, as people that are more important to determining those psychological qualities than the gender we belong to.
And you were drawing on research that has been done over many, many years, people exploring gender differences. You approached this with a hypothesis about gender similarities. Are you hoping that this will inspire future research?
Certainly, I think the devil is in the details, as they often say. And I think there is a lot of value in exploring these pockets of difference, but as well as these pockets of similarities. At one level, a very large question is always likely to have a very large answer that is going to be unsatisfactory to someone. Often the important knowledge we do get is looking at the specifics as well as the generalities.
I'm talking with Zlatan Krijan. He's an associate professor of psychology at Iowa State University. We're going to spend the hour talking about the differences and similarities between men and women. You are welcome to join our conversation with your questions, your observations, 866-780-9100. And joining us now is anthropologist Emily Wenzel of the University of Iowa. She's an assistant professor of anthropology. Hello, Emily.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Now, welcome back to the show. And in just about a minute and a half, can you give me your first impression to the findings of the study?
I think it's a lovely study because, as you've been hearing, we're a culture obsessed with gender difference. We find what we look for, basically. So this study flips that on its head and says, actually, when we look for similarity, that's overwhelmingly what we find. And I think it's especially interesting and rings very true that the differences we see are differences related to gender stereotypes and expectations. So basically, we're a culture that looks for difference, creates difference, and then embellishes that difference.
So as the hour goes on, we'll talk a lot about the things that were found in this study and also things that have been found over time. This has been a focus of your research and interest over time.
Yeah, absolutely. As a cultural anthropologist, I'm very interested in how the cultural context shapes people's lives and their bodies. And there are huge changes going on in the world in ideas about how men should be and how women should be, which also include increasing ideas about similarity, a change from these sort of rigidly defined roles to a more shared central role. So that's something we see in a lot of places in the world.
And Zlatan, as we talk about cultural differences, did you also break that down in your study? Did you look at differences and similarities culture by culture as well?
We try to. The data is relatively lopsided in terms of its distribution across different countries and cultures. We do show this breakdown between research samples that are largely Euro-American versus research samples that tend to be more multicultural, for example, involving East Asians or individuals from South America. And in general, we don't see a very big difference as a function of that split in these gender differences.
Interesting. We'll take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. My guests today are Zlatan Krijan. He's an associate professor of psychology at Iowa State University, and Emily Wenzel, assistant professor of anthropology at the University of Iowa. You are also welcome to join our conversation, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we are talking about men and women. We have a lot of cultural biases about the differences between men and women. We celebrate it in popular culture. There have been many, many studies done on the differences between men and women. This hour, we're talking about the differences and the similarities. Zlatan Krijan is here. He's an associate professor of psychology at Iowa State University, and he recently published a study that analyzed data collected on 12 million individuals to better understand the differences and similarities between men and women. He found more similarities than differences. And anthropologist Emily Wenzel is here. She is an assistant professor of anthropology at the University of Iowa. And I have to say, Emily, when I read about this research, I thought, well, of course, we're the same species. We have more similarities than we have differences between the genders. But we do focus on the differences. But isn't that where the interest lies? I mean, isn't that sort of a natural arena that we would focus as opposed to thinking about all the ways that we're the same?
Yeah, I think in some ways, absolutely. There's a ton of human diversity. And what I think is interesting is how we pick out some kinds of human diversity as definitive of the self, as crucial for your life, and other kinds of diversity as interesting and maybe even noteworthy, but not sort of definitive of who you really are as a person. For example, every form you fill out, you check male or female, which is also a problem for people who don't conform neatly to those boxes. But you never check, are you right-handed or left-handed? Or a good singer or a bad singer, right? So there are all these sort of types of human diversity happening, but certain ones we really attach a ton of social meaning to. And I think that is important to think critically about, because do we like those meanings that we're attaching?
Well, when I think about a human being, I mean, if somebody says, oh, I met someone today, then that's the first piece of information I want to know about that person. That is the key information that I start building an image of a person on. Is their gender.
Absolutely. I do too. But I think that's a very cultural thing, right? When a baby is born, the first question is, oh, is it a boy or a girl? And a few years ago, there was actually a couple who resisted answering that question. I don't know if you recall. And they just said, no, it's a baby. We're just not going to reveal the sex of the baby. And people freaked out. They were intensely uncomfortable because that is, in our culture, the primary thing that defines you, which again then becomes problematic for people who are transgender or don't fit into to one box.
As you mentioned, gender is such a salient social perception category. It's something we notice about individuals right away. It's probably the first question that comes to our mind. As a matter of fact, if you ask a person to imagine an individual, they will never imagine a genderless individual. The gender will always be a part of how we conceive of a person. And as a matter of fact, it's such a formalized category in social life, that is to say, it restricts certain opportunities or provides others. And so because it's so deeply ingrained, I think, in us, which is sort of a separate psychological question, right? But it's so deeply ingrained for us to pay attention to gender. And it has been historically and evolutionarily obviously very important for us to pay attention to that. That just may be a difficult baggage to drop, especially in modern society when we're exposed to so much complex information.
Well, and you mentioned, I mean, it's clearly something that we need to know for the survival of our species. So isn't this possibly something that we just evolved to focus on?
I think that absolutely. And evolutionary psychologists are often very comfortable with existing gender differences because they often fit certain evolutionary theories. For example, the finding report here too, that men are much more interested in beauty and physical appearance than women, even though that has been challenged as well. But that is a relatively strong finding that sort of fits with the evolutionary ideas about gender. But also the importance of paying attention to gender, which sort of what we've just been discussing, right, may be part of our evolutionary heritage as well, such as that when we think about men and women today, that is also evolutionary holdover that impacts how we behave and think about things.
I think it's very interesting that in our culture and in cultures all over the world, many industries have been built around taking advantage of what we perceive as these differences. I mean, when I go to the store to buy soap, there's a men's soap section, there's a women's soap section, although presumably we all get clean just about the same way. But I mean, that's very interesting that we do magnify these differences in marketing.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, yeah, attending to gender in some way is probably a deeply human thing. But different cultures and societies across time have had very different ideas about what men and women and gender are. And yeah, we can't separate our current cultural norms about gender and our real focus on sex difference from the consumer capitalist world we live in, right? There's a ton of money to be made off telling men and women that their bodies are so different that you need two shaving creams and you can charge more for the women's, incidentally. A few years ago, Amazon blew up because Bic pens, right, were selling Bic for her pens, and there were lots of hilarious, snarky reviews. But yeah, what's the logic behind that? That men and women are somehow so different that you need a different writing implement, and really you can make a lot of money off that. You can't buy one pack of pens for the house, you need two. So I think we can't separate ideas about our sort of biological past and evolution from this current climate of media focusing on difference and capitalism making money from it.
Well, and of course, there's been a lot of controversy over how much toys are marketed to girls versus boys. And that's something that really has increased, I would say, in the last 30 years. I mean, it increased in the last 50 years. You know, there was a time when toys were just toys, and now there's the pink aisle and there's the blue aisle. Do you see that this is something that's growing in our culture?
Absolutely. I think Lego is a great example. In the 70s and 80s, their ads had, you know, boy and a girl dressed the same in overalls playing with Legos. In the 2000s, Lego came out with sets called Belleville that are specifically for girls that actually don't involve the same spatial relations learning as the Lego boy-typed sets do, right? They often have a prince and a princess, so you've got gender and romantic roles there. And it's prefab. And I think going back to the nature-nurture question through consumer capitalism, that means that toddlers who get these different toys actually, neurally speaking, develop different abilities, right? If you're a toddler boy and you're given these blocks, you're learning things and you're creating brain connections that a toddler girl given a little princess in a prefab castle isn't going to make. So I think we can't really separate out culture and biology because we see this difference. We actually create biological difference given culture.
This is a great, great point. And as a matter of fact, one of the largest gender differences, which has been on the books for a long time, is in mental rotation ability. So when it comes to skills such as rotating a three-dimensional figure in one's imagination and being able to match it to actual three-dimensional figures out there, men tend to do much, much better at that. As we've just heard, boys are very much encouraged to engage in activities that develop those kinds of skills and develops the neural connections that are important for executing those things well. And conversely, little girls are encouraged to communicate, to care about others' feelings, and develop social skills in ways that boys often don't. And you see that also in sibling research, such as that. You know, boys that grew up with sisters benefit from some of those things, just as girls that grew up with brothers tend to benefit from some of those basically kind of cross-pollination of abilities, especially if they're similar in age.
We're talking this hour about differences between the genders and similarities, the overwhelming number of similarities between men and women, boys and girls. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me this hour, Zlatan Krijan. He's an associate professor of psychology at Iowa State University. Emily Wenzel, assistant professor of anthropology at the University of Iowa. Now, at the same time, I'm a mom, and I have a daughter, and I have a son, and there are many ways in which they cross the gender stereotypes, but then there are many ways in which they reinforce gender stereotypes. And one of them, when my daughter was a baby, she had no interest in balls. That was just, we had balls. She didn't seem to care. My son, when he was 3 weeks old, would track a ball moving across the room. And it just seemed like a very early indication of different interests and made me think, well, all right, that seems like a fundamental biological difference between boys and girls. And sometimes when I hear these conversations, I think, you know, are we obscuring the actual differences between boys and girls with our debate over some of the differences that we are laying upon them? Emily, do you have thoughts about that?
I do. I mean, there are definitely some differences. And again, because you can't sort of pull humans out of culture, it's in a sense impossible to know nature, nurture, because they're completely combined. But I do think what we attend to shapes what we see. And I think Zlatan's study really shows that, right? If you look for difference, you find it. If you look for similarity, you find it. So often when a young child is doing a sort of gender normative thing, it's noticed and it's praised. And if they do a thing that doesn't conform to gender, either it sort of flies under the radar, people don't see it, or they see it as individual versus a characteristic of sex, or they heavily police it, often in the case now of boys. I think little girls are given now more freedom in terms of their toy choice and things like that.
Very interesting. Zlatan, do you have anything to add to that?
I think the complexity of the nature-nurture relationship is an important one here. So even with the clearly, let's say, biological differences. So if you look at the size and strength, there's very little doubt that the men in general have much larger muscles, can move more weight, and that's a pretty large gender difference, and one that is sowed by our genes to a large extent. But now, if you take a boy that could potentially become extremely strong, and that boy is malnourished for the first 20 years of his life, he's never going to develop the strength that he had the genetic potential to develop for. So one way to think about these things, rather than thinking about differences that are sort of hardwired and physically, biologically determined, and others that sort of are either not there or are learned, is that we all come to the world and into the world with some of these sort of predisposition. And when it comes to some of the physical, biological differences, those predispositions are pretty strong, and they'll be evident when it's much more likely to find a boy tracking a ball than a girl. But of course, there are many paths in life, and sometimes developmental trajectories may cross from, for example, boys and girls that would be expected to sort of show one trend, as you described with your children, but may end up showing another because there are many other factors that can impinge on or modulate these biological predispositions.
Let's go to the phones. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Nate is on the line in Durant. Hi, Nate.
Well, hi, Charity. Actually, interestingly enough, your son and my son play on the same basketball league, and I think you and I were even coaches on their first night of practice. I'm sorry,
right.
I didn't recognize you at the time.
Yeah, well, that's true. All right, what would you like to talk about?
Exactly that point, because, you know, at that early age where people are just learning skills, it kind of surprised me that there was a boys' team and there was a girls' team, and it wasn't as though any of the kids out there were like, you know, Michael Jordan or anything like that, and it kind of surprised me a little bit, just enough to kind of make a note of it, and I thought I would call and ask what you thought the implications were, that at the earliest kind of stages of athletic development, girls and boys kind of still remain separated. And it doesn't seem to make a lot of sense to me. So I just kind of wanted to call and get your opinion. And I'll
take
your answer off the
great
air.
Question. Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling, Nate.
Take care.
Yeah. Emily, do you want to respond to that?
Yeah. I mean, I think Nate's observation is a fantastic one, right? There's absolutely no reason why little girls and little boys, like you said, there's no Michael Jordans, shouldn't learn sports together. But there are huge cultural reasons, right? I think even to do with ideas about sexuality, adult sexuality, that are sort of put on children, that there's going to be locker rooms, perhaps, or some kind of taboo. So it's sort of taboo to have cross-gender sports practice. And I think that's something we need to examine and I would say dismantle. I would say that sort of cultivating difference where it doesn't need to be cultivated.
Now, I have heard that there is research that shows that children self-select and start separating when they play, boys and girls separating when they play, as early as kindergarten and first grade. And that tends to really intensify as kids go through elementary school. And some people would say that's just kids choosing to be with their own gender. Others say, well, there must be, you know, other factors at play. We must be encouraging them to isolate themselves by gender. What is your response to that?
Yeah, I would say definitely I think children sort by interest, and often there might be interest shared within a gender. But I think you also at the cafeteria table see sorting by race, right? And that's cultural, right? It's a very segregated society we live in. And I think it's the same to do with sex. So we wouldn't say there's something inherent in a person that makes you only want to socialize with your own kind, because how are we even defining your own kind? That's cultural. But that it's this messy combination of people are enculturated to have shared interests, so they then play them out.
That's, if I may add to that, Dr. Wenzel's point about the race and gender is a very apropos one. I think we all have to be resistant to sort of essentialist accounts of gender difference. So with race is a good example here, because if we do observe many race differences today in modern society, unfortunately still in the United States, you'll find very few people who would say that those race differences are innate or somehow biological. Not just that it's socially unacceptable today, a lot of what we learned suggests that that's simply not true. Now, with gender, it seems like we always have this tendency to want to find an essential difference, to kind of make this essentialist account of gender differences. So even when there are gender differences, I think we're very quick to make him a very deep or very fixed or very permanent. And as the discussion we just had suggests, they're often very flexible and a result of both sort of what children themselves do and the directions we steer them in.
We're talking about the differences and similarities between the genders today. You're welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And I want to talk about romance a little bit, because as I mentioned early in the show, that book from the 1990s, Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, it sold over 50 million copies. I mean, that was a book, and it's just one of many that really touched a chord for people. And I think because, of course, we want to be successful in romantic relationships, we want a way to explain away any frustrations that we might be experiencing and a way to get better at having romantic relationships in the future. But when you look at that kind of demand for a self-help culture that will explain the differences between men and women, what are your thoughts, Emily?
Well, I think, again, going back to capitalism, that was a huge seller, right? So I think also by explaining differences, you create and entrenched differences, right? So when people learn the differences, they play them out and they say, oh, men do this, women do this. And so then that's how you act in the world. That's how you teach your children. That's how you yourself actually act. So I think those kind of books both reflect real existing differences that I would say are cultural, because there's no sort of set universal way to do romance across human time and space, right? Valentine's Day wasn't always there. Roses have not always been a symbol. So you learn to do those things, then you continue to play them out.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Emily Wenzel, Assistant Professor of Anthropology at the University of Iowa, and Zlatan Krijan, who is Associate Professor of Psychology at Iowa State University. We're talking about the differences between men and women and the similarities this hour. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about men and women. Men are not from Mars. Women are not from Venus. We're all from planet Earth. That's the finding of Zlatan Krijan. He's an associate professor of psychology at Iowa State University. He recently published a study that analyzed a huge amount of data, 12 million individuals, to better understand the differences between men and women. His research was published in The American Psychologist. Emily Wenzel is here. She is assistant professor of anthropology at the University of Iowa. And you're welcome to join our conversation as well. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we're going to talk more about romance in a moment, but I want to get to the phones as well. Susan is on the line from West Des Moines. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Charity.
Hi, what would you like to talk about?
That I wanted to make is that I have, two children. And one thing I have to constantly remind myself, I have a boy and a girl, is to be very aware and not allow my perception of how they should behave according to their gender to stifle their individual personality differences. And it was a constant reminder. My kid's father was from Puerto Rico, and for a while we lived there. And at a very young age, you know, they pierced the baby girl's ears, and all these little girls are very, it seemed like there was a little more emphasis on gender at a very young age. And that was kind of uncomfortable with that, coming from the Midwest. So we had to consciously make an effort to make sure, like my mother-in-law was upset that we didn't pierce my daughter's ears. And then when she was two or three, we cut her hair short like her brother's. And she would wear some of her brother's hand-me-down clothes. And she'd say, well, people are going to think she's a little boy. And I said, well, she's 3 or 4 years old. She doesn't care if she's a little boy. And that kind of thing. And then as they got older, I remember my daughter all of a sudden for the first time when she was 6 or 7 saying, I don't have enough dresses. Well, that never came to her mind until she went to school and all these little girls had dresses and she felt she had enough, didn't have enough dresses. But you make a long story short, my son, as far as their personality goes, my son seems like a more, I don't know if you'd call it a feminine attribute to his personality. He was very sensitive, a little more formal in conversation, certainly less aggressive when they were little. My daughter was maybe a little more physically aggressive than my son was. And later, even though my daughter struggled with math when she was younger, we told her, well, you know, you can do anything that you put the time into. And today my daughter is a mechanical engineer and my son works for an international nonprofit organization. So I think I remember it always being a mental effort to consciously remind myself to allow them to express themselves as individuals and not impose my idea of genders upon them.
Well, Susan, thank you so much for sharing that. And it is really interesting, Zlatan, when looking at your study, I mean, you mentioned impulsivity earlier and that you didn't find statistically that men were more impulsive than women, right?
Much, much more.
Okay.
Yeah, just to be clear. So these differences are very, very, very small.
Oh, okay, all right. Now, but when looking at that, I mean, that plays into what Susan is saying because, you know, talking about impulsivity and aggression. I mean, our prisons are disproportionately filled with men. And your research wouldn't show that men are that much more inclined to impulsive or even aggressive behavior, right?
Well, when it comes to physical aggression, there is a pretty sizable gender difference, as I mentioned at the outset. So there would definitely be one exception. Mm-hmm. But I think this raises another important point. There is a difference in aggression on average, right? Now, what happens when you start looking at individuals who are at the extreme of a dimension, let's say very aggressive people, what happens, and this is sort of a statistical principle, is those differences that are small or moderate on average get to become very large or extremely large in the extremes of the distribution. So when you look at very aggressive people, a very aggressive man is going to be much more aggressive than an aggressive woman. And that is, for example, evident by the prison populations, by the fact that perpetrators of violent crime are more than 80% men, etc. And those are the things we tend to notice. Similar, if you look at the sort of a difference in sort of a orientation toward people among women. Yeah, women are much more likely to, for example, care for others and enter those occupations. And that becomes even more evident when you look, for example, at nursing staff or caretaking staff at homes, where you need to have very agreeable and very caring people. Those differences get exaggerated. So I think the even differences that are true are very easily noticeable in certain contexts, and we do notice them. And that way they are reaffirmed and continue perhaps to guide and reinvigorate these differences, both perceived and real.
You know, I want to move back into the arena of romance. And as somebody who grew up with two older brothers, I was always giving my friends advice about boys that they were interested in because there seemed to be this cultural stereotype that, you know, boys don't have the same kind of feelings that girls have, that they are not as shy. They are not as scared of asking somebody out. And, you know, having brothers, I knew all of that wasn't true. But, you know, we do create these constructs that force men into this role of having to take the initiative in romantic relationships often, although you hear a lot of stories otherwise, women who weren't willing to wait. But, I mean, Emily, what are your thoughts about that?
It's funny you should ask, because to share briefly a personal story, I actually got engaged over the weekend, and we decided we didn't like the gender norms of the man sort of decides when and where, so we each got on one knee and counted to three, and we said, 1, 2, 3, propose! We proposed.
Congratulations!
Thank you. But so I think you can consciously sort of depart from those roles. And going back to self-help books, for example, yeah, culturally we know there are scripts. There's a way women are supposed to be in relationships, and men are supposed to be in relationships. Then there's a huge industry telling you what that is, helping you figure it out, going on talk shows. I was watching Steve Harvey over lunch recently, and he was telling women their dating mistakes, what they were doing wrong, what men actually wanted to see. So if it were natural and biological, you then wouldn't need to constantly be told and have all these maps to help you figure out what's going on. So it's sort of a just-so story that we then are all very engaged in learning.
Yeah, we get a very different prescription of how is a man, how men ought to go about finding a romantic partner and how a woman ought to go about it and what are the things, the do's and don'ts, as we just heard. And that the recipe is likely to be very much culturally constructed.
This is a question from Brian. He says, can your guests speak to relations among people of the same gender? It seems to me that how women relate to men women and how men relate to men has a lot to do with how each group in turn interacts with the other. Emily?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great point. I think in terms of same-sex romantic relationships, there have been interesting recent studies that show that norms are much more fluid. So in terms of housework in heterosexual relationships, you know, even despite the women's movement, women are the ones who are doing the bulk of the care work and the household work. But when you get two women or two men, things tend to be decided much more along personality lines. I think in terms of same-sex friendships and stuff like that, that's both a place where you can sort of cross norms and fight against them, but also a place where they're really powerfully reinstantiated and you learn how to be a woman or you learn how to be a man collectively with people of the same sex.
This hour, we haven't talked a lot about some of the places in our society where we see inequality between the genders in education or in work, in pay for the same work. But aside from those arenas, do you think that it's harmful, Emily, for men and women to be thought of as so different?
In many ways, yes. I don't think difference itself is harmful. I think there's a lot of difference in humanity. And I think there are obvious, you know, we have different genitalia, some people can give birth. But I think to attribute everything to gender and has, as Zlatan was saying earlier, an essentialist understanding that this is how men are, this is how women are, that then can be used politically to reinforce inequalities and to stop social change for the positive. So I think it's important to notice the difference we have, to realize that it's from this mix of biology and culture that we can't ever separate, and then to think very critically about why are we focusing on this? Do we like that we are?
Looking around the world in different cultures, I mean, we recently saw the Obamas traveling to Saudi Arabia and a lot of conversation about the fact that Michelle Obama didn't cover her head when she was there. And that really brings into relief the very stark gender differences in that society that are imposed by rule of law. But when you look around other cultures where there aren't laws that control men and women differently in that way, what are some of the ways that you see these gender stereotypes turned upside down?
That's a great question. I mean, actually, I think in Saudi Arabia, though, one example is that male friends hold hands. Years ago, there was a famous picture of George Bush and the Saudi king holding hands, right? So I think what in one culture is this rigid no-go zone or something that's sexualized in another culture is not. Across human history, there have just been lots and lots of different diverse ways of doing masculinity or femininity. There also haven't always been just two genders in different cultures. Lots of Native American tribes had two-spirit people. In India, there's the Hijra people. So just there's not even always two. And in many cultures, an anthropologist called Margaret Mead, a famous anthropologist in the 1930s, wrote a book called Sex and Temperament in Three Primitive Societies. Primitive wasn't an insult back then. And went around Melanesia and discussed three different groups, highlighting how they were all different from American gender roles. Women and men in two were different and one were very similar to each other, but none of them were being women and men in the same way Americans would expect. So in anthropology, at least, it's been sort of a long-term project of documenting difference. Although with globalization and global media coming out of the West, we do see maybe some homogenization.
Well, and in this country, there, you know, Zlatan, you were mentioning the different jobs that tend to be associated with men or with women. One of those jobs, for example, farmers. Farmers in this country are stereotypically men. In other cultures, they're not necessarily.
Yeah, and I mean, a lot of that does have to do with the physical demands of the laborer in a particular role. So there were, one could say, reasonable sort of motivators for men versus women to engage in certain kind of farm labor. But as you said, globally speaking, farm labor per se could be either male or a female occupation, depending on the time and the culture. So a lot of those things are very, very fluid. And I think this the point that separates the biological sex from gender, which is this socially constructed role, is something we always have to be bear in mind. Gender will never be devoid of biological sex, but will also never be reducible to it.
In your research, Zlatan, was there something about differences between men and women that surprised you?
So there is one, and that is it seemed that the men perform better on a wide variety of tasks in same-sex groups compared to women. So it seemed that for women, being in a same-sex group performing a task was more harmful than for men being in an all-male group performing a task. So it seemed that women got more in each other's way when doing something together. I will leave the interpretation of that to you.
All right. That is fascinating. In your research, did you come up with several questions that you are now hoping to do further research on?
Yes. I mean, we are especially interested in sort of digging behind this global effect. So every time where you find, let's say, a great similarity on a certain domain, you can always break that domain in a sort of individual constituent. And that could hide interesting pattern of opposing differences. And so I think that's one very interesting direction where sort of a global lack of difference may hide a whole pattern of more texture differences underneath.
Interesting. This is an email from Amelie. She said, I'm a woman. I grew up in the 1950s, and being a girl was frustrating for me because I liked all the boy things. I hated dolls. I hated dresses. What I want is a lot less social pressure on children to act one way or another. I was very glad when my daughter grew up that she could continue to play with boys throughout her school years because I wasn't able to. Emily, do you see... In some ways, I mean, we've talked about the pink aisle and the blue aisle, and there's so much of that now. And 30 years ago, there wasn't as much of that. But there's also pushback now. And we saw even the ad during the Super Bowl, the ad about what does it mean to run like a girl. We are hearing these messages, I think, in a lot more high-profile places and in a lot more high-profile ways. Do you feel hopeful that there is progress being made on this?
I do, although I also think it needs sort of concerted political effort behind it. I think in some ways we're in kind of a backlash moment, actually. There have been a lot of gains, thanks to the feminist movement, for men and women and boys and girls in terms of role flexibility. But yeah, as you said, and I think especially because there's money to be made off it, toys are far more gendered than they've ever been. Clothes are far more gendered than they've ever been. And we still have inequality in terms of things like pay for men and women. So I think it's a time of backlash that we need to really consciously work against to continue to say, yes, we have these differences, but they're not natural, they're not essential, and this is how we're creating them.
And Zlatan, psychological studies that are published in journals don't necessarily always get a lot of media attention. You've been getting a lot of attention for this study. Have you been surprised by the interest in it?
Somewhat. I did expect to be some interest, given this is sort of a topic that everybody has an opinion about. But it did surprise me just how much interest there is. I was happy to hear that it was generally positive interest, and I hope it'll remain so.
Have you been talking about this research with your students?
I'm actually on a sabbatical this semester, so besides my graduate students, I didn't have a lot of opportunity, but thanks to you, I certainly had one today.
All right. And Emily, this is a topic that I'm guessing you talk about with your students quite a lot.
All the time.
And is this a topic that gets people going?
It absolutely is. I think especially when we start to pick apart nature-nurture and culture and biology, one of the, I think, mind-blowing and also exciting things for students is to think about that there's no biology outside of culture, and there's no culture without biology. So we're both totally making all this be true, but we're also making our bodies into what we expect them to be. That's one of my favorite things about anthropology.
Emily Wenzel, thank you so much.
Thanks.
Emily Wenzel is an assistant professor of anthropology at the University of Iowa. Zlatan Krijan, thank you so much.
Thank you both.
Zlatan Krijan is an associate professor of psychology at Iowa State University, and as you've heard, he recently published a study that analyzed data collected on 12 million individuals to better understand the differences and similarities between men and women. Talk of Iowa is produced by Lindsay Moon, Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, Claire Roth, and Julia Davis. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Tomorrow on the program, an archive edition of Talk of Iowa, we'll talk about pediatric bereavement. You can email us anytime, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.